Wonderful. Right, so with no more ado, we will. Right, so as we go on in this new adventure, as it were, this new venture, let's say, but it's also a new advent. What we are exploring, what we are touring, is the Talmud. And I realize what kind of tour it is. Let's say you had a tour of Rome, and it was a Jewish organization doing the tour. So they're going to pick out the sites in Rome which have some kind of Jewish interest. And so what we, or I, hopefully you as well, are trying to do here, we are touring the Talmud, looking at points where the Talmudic tradition and the mystical Hasidic tradition touch. Because for a long time, these were seen as two contrasting areas. Either Neglet, revealed Torah, meaning Talmud, or Hasidic teachings. And then comes the ideas I mentioned 2 weeks ago, the Tzemach Tzedek, trying to put the two together in his book, Derech Mitzvotecho, The Path of Your Mitzvot, some of which might have been translated, where he takes a mitzvah of the Torah and analyzes the mitzvah both in halachic terms. He was a very great, famous halachist as well. His responsa, his Sha'alot u'Tshuvot, fill several large volumes and were printed posthumously, but very soon after he passed away. And it was only nearly a century later that all his many very, very voluminous Hasidic teachings were printed. And this is something the Rebbe himself very much wanted, to join together Nigla and Hasidut, the revealed Torah and Hasidic dimension. So we are now. Oh, not in the other room. So we are now looking at this passage of Brachot, and so what we had in the mission. So we're looking at page 3A, folio 3A, and we might get on to 3B as well. Just before, about 25 minutes ago, I sent out the final version of the text for this evening's session. So it's a selected text. You see, it's Brachot 3a, taking certain passages. And as mentioned, we are basing ourselves partly on Rabbi Adinsteinsaltz's elucidation of the Talmud, which he wrote in Hebrew, and it was then translated into English, and it's available to everyone on Sefaria, the website Sefaria, in their Talmudic text of the Babylonian Talmud, that is Adinsteinsaltz. And we are also using very closely for this evening a book called Nishmata Doraita, which has recently been published. So far, three volumes have appeared, and it goes through the Talmud, page by page, finding a Hasidic dimension for what's on the page. So what I'm trying to do here with you is simply translate this Nishmata Doraita. So Nishmata, or summarize it. Nishmata Doraita is written by two people I haven't had yet, unknowingly, the good fortune to meet them. One is called Rabbi Yehuda Cohen. The other one is called Rabbi Yehuda Leib Weissglass. And I hope eventually I will run into them. I'm not even sure whether they live in Israel or America, where they are. But they put together an extremely wonderful work. The three volumes published so far cover several tractates of the Talmud, and we are looking at the tractate Brachot. So here we are on 3A. So that means it's the second page for Mysterious reasons, every volume of Talmud always begins on folio page two. And one of the explanations is, however much Talmud you study, you've never actually got to the first page, because the first page, page one, was never printed. So now it mentions Ad Sof HaShmurah. The point is that the first Mishnah in Brachot is talking about saying the evening Shema. And 2 weeks ago, we considered this various, various aspects of it, spiritual aspects, saying the Shema in the evening. The evening suggests negativity of various kinds, and nonetheless, in the middle of that negativity, one is still able to say the Shema, proclaiming the oneness of God. Now, so when does one begin saying the Shema? One begins saying it when it's nightfall. And when three stars come out is a common way of elucidating when is nightfall. And one can say it until, and then there's a variety of suggestions when one is able to say that, till when come and say the Shema. So it said Ad Sof HaShmurah, till the end of the first watch, right? So the passage in bold is the actual translation, and the rest of it is a kind of explanation. Now, the word Mishma is the word for watch, right? So you see this HaShmurah. So Ad Sof HaShmurah HaRishonah, till the end of the first watch. Like I'm using this English word watch, or that's what's generally used, three watches has the night or something like that. So they're mentioned as segments of the night, but then comes the question, how many are there? And my kasava Rabbi Eliezer, why is it? Rabbi Eliezer is the person who says it's till the end of the first watch. What does Rabbi Eliezer think? If he thinks the night has got three watches, lema, let him say ad arba shaot, till the fourth hour. If we imagine that the night begins at 6 in the evening and ends 6 in the morning, and there are three watches. So each watch is 4 hours. And so he could say, till the end of the fourth hour, that's how long you can say the Shema. E kasava arba mishmarot hevi alayla. But if he thinks that there are four watches in the night, then each one is 3 hours, right? Simple arithmetic. 4 into 12 means three. Lema ad shalosh sa'ot. So let him say till the end of the third hour. Why does he use this word watches? So the Talmud comes to the conclusion here. Le'olam kasava shalosh mishmarot havi alayla. Actually, Rabbi Eliezer thinks that there are three watches in the night, v'ha kamashmalon. But he's teaching us something extra. Now, this is before we get into the mystical tradition and what the Zohar says or anything like that. This is the Talmud in itself. Why does Rabbi Eliezer say, use this ambiguous statement about watches, in order to tell us how, till when you can say the evening Shema? He could have just said till the third hour, till the fourth hour. Why does it say watches? It's teaching us. The there are watches in heaven. The and there are watches on earth. The Tanya, as we learn, Rabbi Eliezer, the same Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer Omer says, Shalosh mishmarot hevi alayla. The night has got three watches. Va'al kol mishma, and at every watch, Yoshev HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He, sits v'shoek ta'ari, and roars like a lion. Shenema, as it says, Hashem mimarom yishag, God roars from on high, umimaon kodsho, and from his sacred place, yiten kolo, he gives forth his voice, shaog yishag al neveyu, he is roaring about his place, his naveyu. Navey is like a beautiful place, meaning in this case, the temple. In other words, God is weeping for the temple or roaring about the temple. It's obviously a very anthropomorphic statement, right? We're aware of the battle over anthropomorphism in Jewish texts, whether it's in biblical texts where there's a strong anthropomorphic element, and in Talmudic and Midrashic texts, and here we see an example of one. And we know that Maimonides, in Guide for the Perplexed, tried to explain away these anthropomorphic passages in the Bible. The whole first section of Guide for the Perplexed takes one by one anthropomorphic passages in the Bible and tries to show a deeper philosophic dimension of meaning. And he certainly believed the same thing is true in Talmudic texts as well. And so we now have this text, and the question is, what do we understand about this text? Now, so this idea of this roaring of the divine, it goes on in the Talmud and says, V'siman l'davar, and there is a sign concerning this. Mishmara, you see, the thing is that the watches, each of the watches defines a kind of divine response. There's a divine response of this roaring about this exilic state of the world. Now, this is something very profound, because the temple is destroyed, meaning that the Jewish people are in exile. But when the Jewish people are in exile, existence is in exile. So the roaring of the divine is actually an expression of pain about the nature of existence. Existence is in a state of exile. Then, in addition to these heavenly punctuations, as it were, the heavenly watches, there is also the effect that the watch has on the earth. Mishmorah Rishona, at the end of the first watch, Chamor Noer, the donkey brays. Shnia, the second, Klavim Tzakim, dogs bark. Shlishit, the end of the third one, which is more gentle, Tinok Yonek Mishdei Imo, a baby drinks from the breast of his mother, V'isha Mesaperet Im Ba'ala, and wives and husbands waking up in the morning. That's this is like at the to the or at this particular point in the night, they waking up, a wife and husband chat together. So that indicates the different these three watches in the night, and we're talking about just before morning, and that's really and what Rabbi Eliezer wants is we should say the Shema long before the end of the third watch. He wants us to say it by the end of the first watch. If you remember, what it said in the Mishnah that we studied 2 weeks ago was that you could actually say the Shema all the way till the beginning of dawn, not exactly dawn, not sunrise, but the pillar of dawn, the rising of Amud HaShachar, the pillar of dawn, but that the sages say you should say it by midnight, because otherwise one might tend to forget and it's very bright daylight. So here we have this way of measuring that there are these three heavenly watches. L'mainak nafkamina. So what is the difference? What difference does it make that we should have these indications of when is the end of the night? L'mikre kriyat shema, l'man degane b'beit afel. By telling us that the effect of the third watch has in this world, the end of the first watch, there was the donkey bray, the end of the second watch in the night. The dogs are barking. And now comes the third watch. And what is happening there? There, for someone who is sleeping in a dark room, he doesn't know when he can begin to say the morning Shema. We've moved here to the morning Shema. If a wife and husband are chatting together in the early morning, and this baby wants to drink from its mother's breast, then he knows it's time to say the morning Shema, Lekum v'likri, let him get up and let him say the Shema. So there we have this concept of the three Mishmarot, the three watches of the night, and Rabbi Yitzhak, here we have Omar Rabbi Yitzhak Bar Shmuel, Mishmei the Rav, Rabbi Yitzhak, the son of Shmuel, said in the name of Rav, Shalosh Mishmarot Havealaila, the night has got three watches, and we come back to this point, V'omer, V'al Kol Mishmar, and at every watch, Yoshev HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One sits, and roars like a lion, v'omer, and he says, this is the extra thing here which we didn't have before. Oy she'echarabti et beiti, woe that I destroyed my temple, v'sarafti et heichali, I burnt my the another a part, the inner part of the temple, v'higleiti et banai, and I made my children go into exile, levein umot ha'olam, into among the nations of the world. So here we have this sort of grief of the divine, this grief of the divine, and the grief is because of the Churban, the destruction which is there. Now, incidentally, in the 13th century, I think it was Pope Innocent III, was egged on by a Jewish convert to Christianity, to say that the Talmud is blasphemous. And he picked out 29 points in the Talmud. And I don't know, I don't remember, I did at some point read through all those 29 points. I don't remember that it's exactly this point, but it's something very similar was one of his 29 points. How can you say, because there are many such passages in the Talmud, and every day God, it's the same theme, it's repeated in many places. So from the point of view of Christianity and the Pope, how could it be that God is weeping that he destroyed the temple? It's God who destroyed the temple after all. Everything that happens comes from God. And so why should he weep? Why should he regret it? It's blasphemous. And as a result of this claim that it's blasphemous, there was the dispute in Paris, in which Rabbi Yechiel of Paris had to, this is 1240, Rabbi Yechiel of Paris, and who was a Tosafist, and there were a group of other rabbis with him, tried to defend the Talmud, and the Talmud was found guilty, right? In medieval style, it's the Talmud that was being accused. Rabbi Yechiel was trying to defend the Talmud, but the Talmud was found guilty, and as a result, all the volumes of Talmud, which in 1240 were manuscript volumes, were confiscated in France, and they were brought to a square in Paris. Some people say they know which square it is, and the Talmud was burnt. I think the number is 24 cartloads of Talmudic manuscript, and that drove Torah learning out of France for centuries, and instead it moved eastwards to Germany and then Poland. So this has a strong historical effect, these passages. However, let's try and look at it in terms of Hasidic teachings. And here we have taken from this book, Nishmat HaDoraita, the soul of the Torah, and it is a passage from, let's just see where it's from, the footnote. So this is their book. It's from a discourse of Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Lodi, and also from Rabbi Dov Ber, his son, the second Lubavitcher Rebbe in Torah Chaim. So it gives the reference here. So let's just see what it says.
Ali, are we, can we ask questions?
Yes, okay, I tell you what, before we get into this, let's ask questions.
Okay. So I have a quick question. Does the Gemara examine what the connection is between HaKadosh Baruch Hu bewailing the destruction of the temple at each watch? What's the connection that each watch provokes this reaction?
I don't think the Talmud goes into the those distinctions, right? It tells us in general that there are the three watches, and each one is defined in this way in the world: donkeys braying, dogs barking, and so on. But I don't think it gives a sort of a nuanced aspect to God weeping, his roaring. That seems to be the same roar at each junction.
Okay, and another question, a quick question is when the question started out as when can you still say Shema throughout the night? And then we brought the simonim about the watches, and then we answered it by saying that when the third watch, I think the third when the third watch is over, I guess you need to rise and say Shema, but that's for the daytime. That
Yes.
is not for the night. Then we miss the
Correct.
night. We're supposed to tell him when he's able to finish saying for the night, not when he's about obligated to say for the day.
To be honest, I think the Mishnah itself that we studied last week, 2 weeks ago, sort of sorted out the question of till what time at night, and there's the view of Rabbi Eliezer. There are other opinions, and there's the sages, and it's really all sorted out halachically in the Mishnah. So what's coming later is a kind of discussion of another dimension, which is there in this concept.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Bob.
If God has no attributes, as Maimonides says, how can he have pain?
Absolutely. And yet, I'm sure you are cognizant of the fact that the Raivad criticizes, Maimonides says, anyone who thinks God has some kind of form is apikores, is a heretic. And the Raivad comments on that. Better than him, that means better than Maimonides, did have such opinions. But he then says, because they were studying these muddled up midrashim. So the Raivad, Rabbi Avraham ben Dovid Poskea, seems to agree with Maimonides. And I must say, we will find Hasidic teachings also agreeing with him. One of the teachings that we have here today, it says, God forbid, how can you say God has a form? So this is one of the many paradoxes of Jewish thought where we have two opposites operating at the same time, and the idea that God has no form. It's not only a matter of anthropomorphism, getting rid of anthropomorphism. Maimonides wants to get rid of anthropopathic terminology. To say that God feels joy, happiness, or anything like that, that is all reducing God to some kind of, a person. And whereas the Midrash and indeed the Hasidic thought does talk about the will of God and emotional attributes of God. So that's Judaism combining opposites, and its ability to combine opposites is part of this very rich heritage that we all inherit.
And in a similar vein, if God is omniscient, how can he do, why did he set up the world for these terrible things to happen?
Absolutely. That's actually a passage that hopefully we will get to in a little while, a page or two ahead, where it talks about this kind of question of suffering and I mean that's a very valid logical question at a certain level of logic. But in order to deal with the divine, we have to go to a higher level of logic. That's what I'd present at this moment. Okay, so we're going to come back to the text. Here we are. Now we have this passage based on a discourse by Rabbi Schneur Zalman and his son, the Rabbi Dov Ber, in Torat Chaim. So we have this idea that malchut is kingship, right? We do have this idea of the sfirot. That's the sort of the background. The sfirot are there in the Zohar, not usually spoken about directly, but always as some kind of metaphor, like all the rivers flow to the sea, and the sea is never full, and that sea represents the attribute malchut, kingship. So let's see what this says. Malchut is called night. So when we're talking about night, it's really Malchut that we're talking about, kingship, which and kingship also relates to the feminine. And it has three kinds of tzimtzum, three kinds of veiling. Now, veiling of this kind is hinted at in the Zohar and very clearly enunciated by Rabbi Isaac Luria in the 16th century. So Rabbi Isaac Luria taught that at the beginning there was infinite divine radiance everywhere, and there was no room, so to speak, for the world. And then this radiance was veiled, and the word tzimtzum is used, and tzimtzum literally means contracted. So in the next few generations, there were arguments among the Kabbalists, does it literally mean contracted? That means that there's a place where the radiance is not there, or does it simply mean veiling? And one of the theories about an academic theory about the difference between the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim, who were both Kabbalists, the leading Mitnagdim, is that they believed Tzimtzum was to be taken literally, and the Hasidim thought that it's not to be taken literally, it's veiling. Now, these three kinds of tzimtzum, whether contraction or veiling, they are the three watches. They are the three watches of the night. The night is represents malchut, and the three watches are three aspects of tzimtzum. Each stage of veiling, which is called the watch, provokes the roar from atzilut. Now, atzilut is the higher level of revelation of the divine. And that's where the roar comes from, because the word mishmar also means prison, right? In fact, it's a word used. So although the Mishnah is using the word here, the watches of the night, in the Bible we find the word mishmar meaning a prison. Joseph was put in a mishmar. The flow from Malchut descends lower and lower, experiencing veiling after veiling in darker and darker realms. And then the situation is that the lower waters weep, saying, Anan be'inan the meheve kodem malko, we want to be close to the king. That means that as existence, it becomes more obvious, as it were, that there is this veiling of the divine, and existence is forcefully concealing godliness. There is this weeping from below, and in response, there's the roar from above. Now, this imprisonment of the three kinds of mishmar, which we can translate either watch or prison, this Hasidic teaching continues, also applies to each individual. Each person is trapped in their own materiality, forgetting the divine. And the Talmud, a number of times, refers to three kinds of sin which are ubiquitous. Now, the way Rabbi Shneur Zalman cites these sins, two of them he puts in very subtle terms. One of them he leaves as it is. So one kind of sin is theft. So for Rabbi Shneur Zalman, he's not talking about people literally stealing money from someone's wallet. There's theft in spiritual terms. We learn spiritual teachings from one's father and mother. Who are father and mother? Wisdom and understanding. So we learn something wise, a beautiful teaching, and we're supposed to pay back. We're supposed to respond with a feeling of love and of awe. But instead, we don't respond. So we've stolen the teaching. So we've read the beautiful teaching, but we haven't responded. And so that is a kind of stealing of this wisdom. Then, which he does not try to present any kind of allegory, inappropriate erotic thoughts, they're a problem simply as they are. And then there's murder. Now, murder, he explains in spiritual terms, getting angry with a person. He doesn't actually mention this, but shaming a person, it says repeatedly, is like killing the person because you make the person go white, just as if you had stabbed them, and the blood drains away from their face, or speaking Lashon Hara, which he does mention. So these are the three prisons of each individual. Because we are caught in these prisons, causing the Shekhinah to be caught as well, God cries out like a lion roaring. So there we have the idea that it's in our hand it's the Shekhinah, and it is our erratic behavior, which might just be in our thoughts or inconsistencies of various kinds. So I thought that this picture, to me, expresses this famous painting by Munch, The Scream. And is this the scream of one schizophrenic, or whatever, however we want to define this individual, or is it a scream of all existence? Notice the psychedelic rainbow coloring that everything is in, or is it the scream of God? And how should we respond? Should we scream back, or should we do something else? And of course, the Talmud, the Hasidic teaching, wants us to respond by breaking out of these inner prisons so that we break out of the mishmar. And it's very interesting what Avraham mentioned is that we are coming to the morning shema, which is as if we go out through the night and we end up in the morning, and there it's freedom and redemption. So, is there any question or comment to be made about this?
What is the basis for saying that the three contractions are related to the three watches?
That's the whole, Bob, as mentioned 2 weeks ago, that is the whole mystical tradition, A equals B. Why does A equal B? An old friend of mine just passed away, unfortunately, Manny Silver. He was a tremendous Talmudist, and he knew the whole Bible by heart. But he never studied Hasidic teachings. I said to him, "Why don't you study Hasidic teaching?" He says, "Because it says A is Bechinat B, right? Bechina means it's like. A is like B." He said, "What does this word like mean? What does Bechina mean?" And because of the imprecision in that term, he never got into Hasidic thought, which was a great loss, I think, to him. But may he have a luminous Garden of Eden with his Talmud teachings and Tanakh. So all the way through the mystical tradition, there are these perceptions that A is Bechinat B, A is the quality of B. And the three watches are three kinds of exile, That's three kinds of symptom, and that is the nature of the mystical tradition. So that's how it works. I've never seen a real discussion opening up exactly when and how this the ability, the sense of the ability to make these correspondences began. And who can make these? You see, it really turns on the teacher. Is the teacher a charismatic figure who is able to make those correspondences and others can't? You see, if I came along and tried to suggest, A equals B, someone could say, where do you get that from? That's nonsense. So if I had such an idea, I would be looking through indexes and things like that and doing searches, trying to find, oh, Rabbi so-and-so says it in such in the Zohar, in the Midrash. The Midrash makes this kind of connection as well. And it's the interesting step into the world of Midrash, but the world of Midrash is essential for the Talmudic method. The Talmud works out halachic principles on the basis of very similar kind of identifications. A equals B, and therefore something or other, which might affect the price of meat in the butcher shop, because you have to have the mashgiach looking there. Okay. Anyone else? Any other question? Okay.
I have a quick question. So the nighttime is associated with the tzimtzumim,
Yes.
which you're describing as veiling, but it's followed by the day, and the whole day is a night and a day, and that is the system set up by Kodesh Baruch Hu. So does it automatically mean that night is associated with tzimtzumim if this was the original plan to have a long day with being night followed by day?
Well, if we get that far, we'll see that even the night itself is more complex because there's the first half of the night and the second half of the night. So it's more subtle. It's more subtle. Right, okay. Now, here we have an interesting story which seems not quite fully connected on the Talmudic level, but on the Hasidic level, it fits very well. Tanya, we learn in the Braisa. Omer Rabbi Yossi says, Pam achat hayiti mahalech baderech. Once I was walking on the way, v'nichnasti luchuba, and I went into a ruin. Achat. Michuvot Yerushalayim. I went into one of the ruins of Jerusalem, Lehitpalel, to pray. Now he's talking here not just about saying the Shema, but actually saying the Amidah, saying the full prayer, which really is in the next chapter. It's not, it's or a later chapter. Ba'Eliyahu Zachulatov, Elijah the prophet, may his memory be for good, came to me. V'shamani ala petach. And he looked at me at the entrance, vehemently, and he waited for me, till I'd finished my prayer. So he's gone into this ruin, he's praying there, and Elijah the prophet is watching him from the doorway. After I finished my prayer, Amali said to me, Shalom Alecha Rabbi, peace to you, Rabbi. V'amati lo, I said to him, Shalom Alecha, Rabbi Umori, peace to you, my teacher and guide. Va'amali, he said to me, Bni, my son, Mipnei ma nichnasta l'chubazu? Why did you go into this ruin? Amati lo, I said to him, Lehitpalo, I went in to pray. Va'amali, he said to me, Hayalecha lehitpalel baderech. You should have prayed in the street outside. Va'amati lo, I said to him, Mityarei hayiti. I was worried, Shema yafsiku bi ovrei drachim, Maybe the people walking by in the street will disturb my prayer. Va'amali, and he said to me, Hayalecha lehitpalel tfilat. Well, in that case, you should have prayed a short prayer. Now, the Talmud goes on. I didn't copy this out. You know, what's wrong with going into a ruin? And it gives various explanations. He might be suspected of meeting a girl in the ruin, or there might be demons there, or it might fall down. It's physically dangerous. But let's just take this concept in itself. Ba'otasha, at that moment, Lamadati mimenu shlosha dvarim. I learned from him three things. Lamadati she'ein nichnasin l'chuba. I learned that one doesn't go into a ruin. Ve'lamadati she'mitpalelim baderech. And I learned that you do pray on the wayside, on the road, in the street. Ve'lamadati she'hamitpalel baderech. And I also learned that if you are praying on the street, mitpalel tfilat tzara, one should pray a short prayer. Now, that is what it says in the Talmud, and in addition, there's this whole thing. Maybe it's meeting a girl, or it's a ruin, so it's dangerous, or there are demons. However, this passage is cited in Keter Shem Tov. Keter Shem Tov is a Hasidic collection of teachings from the Baal Shem Tov. And some of them are more obviously attributed to the Baal Shem Tov than this one is. And this is a cryptic passage. And Nishmat HaDoraita, the soul of the Torah, doesn't just collect passages. It also expounds them. It either makes them shorter or it expounds them at greater length. And so there we have this exposition, which is based on Keter Shem Tov. Now, when Rabbi Yossi entered the ruin, he was doing so on behalf of the Jewish people who were suffering greatly. That's what is meant by the ruin. So the ruin means the Jewish people as a whole in a very difficult situation. And Rabbi Yossi is going into this ruin in order to help the Jewish people. His intention was to pray with great intensity on their behalf. And in fact, that's exactly what the Baal Shem Tov himself did. He was known to embark on dangerous spiritual battles for the sake of the Jewish people. However, here there's a warning from the Baal Shem Tov, based on this passage, that it's not always advisable to try and undertake this battle. Also, so you have to know when you can enter the battle and when you can't. And there's a time when you can do so, and there's a time when you have to find some other strategy. The straight battle is not going to work. Also, and there are in Shifrei Baal Shem Tov, there is a very striking description of the Baal Shem Tov engaged in such a battle. First of all, the description, what he looked like from the outside, which is that he was standing with his head thrown back, gasping, not a very pretty image. And then he tells us what he experienced during this long, several hours experience. And there's also the famous letter of the Baal Shem Tov where he describes an ascent of the soul, where also that he is trying to help other souls, and he talks there about how dangerous that is itself. Now then, the Baal Shem Tov says another thing. Sometimes, instead of intense solitary prayer, one should cloak one's own prayer with the prayers of the community and pray along the road, keep in the road where people are passing. Don't be yourself alone in a very intense experience, which is too much. Go into the ordinary streets. And it's true, you know, people might disturb you. That's no problem. Wrap your prayers up with them. And in that case, one might also have to reduce the intensity of one's prayer and just pray an abbreviated prayer. Now, the abbreviated prayer, which is printed in some Siddurim, it's not in the Chabad prayer book. It used to be in the Singer's Siddur. I'm not sure if it still is. It begins with the word Havinenu, which means make us understand. And in this context, as explained here, this means one should pray with the simple understanding of the words instead of intense solitary emotion. So here we have the idea from the Baal Shem Tov that what's the word? Pick your battles. You have to know when to fight and when not to fight. Now, in terms of the Talmudic passage, the connection with this incident and what came before is the crying out of God, because it goes on and it says that Elijah asked Rabbi Yossi, "What sound did you hear in the ruin when you were there?" And I said, "I heard the voice from heaven coming like a dove and saying, 'Woe that I destroyed my temple and I burnt my Heichal and I made my children exiled among the nations of the world.'" And Elijah tells him, "You know what? That happens all the time. All the time, God is saying that every single day." And then he goes on to say, "Velozu bilvad." Now, not only this, "Ela b'shar she'Yisrael nichnasin lebatei knesiyot." When the Jewish people go into synagogues, so the batei midrashot and the study house, "ve'onin yehei shmei hagadol mevorach." Now we say, "Yehei shmei Rabbah," may the great name of God be blessed. "Hakadosh baruch hu menaneh roshoh." Here we have another anthropomorphism. God shakes his head and says, "Asrei Amelech," happy is the king, "shemekalsin oto b'beitokach," who is praised in his house in this way. "Ma lo la'av shehiglaid banav." Whoa, what a terrible thing for a father who's driven his children into exile. "V'oy lahem levanim shegalu me'al shulchan avim." Woe to the children who have been exiled from the table of their father. Now we are going to take a message, right? So there's the message of the story, which I've written here. You've got this, it was sent to you. It's true that God weeps at the existential grief of existence. The individual sensitive to this must still try to preserve his or her balance. Don't lose yourself in the existential grief. Also, it's sometimes wise to cloak yourself with the community on the road rather than being a lone mystic in the ruin of existence. Now let's come to this Omein Yehei Shmei Rabbah. This is what Rabbi Shneur Zalman says in Likutei Torah. The Holy One does not have any physical form, God forbid. That's how he writes it. Chas v'shalom. So what does it mean by saying that he shakes his head? Well, it's a metaphor. The head expresses the divine will, Ratzon, which is exalted beyond the other attributes. The Jewish people have a connection with God on that exalted level. That's why the word Yisrael has the letters Li Rosh, I have a head. We have a connection with this head, this Ratzon, this upper will. When they say, "May his great name be blessed," they cause the Ratzon, the will of God, this exalted will, to flow, shaking the head as from above downwards. Thus, the Ratzon flows downwards so that it should be revealed. Within the Ratzon, the will is also concealed the Ta'anug, the divine delight. And this is what is meant by the great name. For the divine names express the revelation of the flow of godliness within the worlds and the order of Hishtalshelut, the downchaining of the worlds. That's the case with the name Elohim and Havaya, Yud-Kei, Vav-Kei, the Tetragrammaton, but the great and other names. But the great name is beyond the downchaining of the Sfirot, just as the Ratzon, will, and the light is higher than the downchaining. So when the Jewish people bless this exalted divine name, which we do in the response in the Kaddish, they draw it into the downchaining of the worlds where it's revealed. So that means starting on a very exalted level, there's the will of the divine flowing down into the lower levels and the delight of the divine, and it's triggered off by us saying this response to the Kaddish. And so here we have a little halachic snippet. We therefore can understand why the response, Amen Yehoshme Rabbah, Mavorach, which is our response to the Kaddish, is so significant that it can interrupt most parts of the prayer service. Then there's exceptions. The middle of Yishtabach, from Shema to Va'ed, between Goel Yisrael and the Amidah, and in the Amidah before the first Yehi Ratzon. But any other part of the prayer, one can respond to this part of the Kaddish. So that is this point that is being made here about the nature of the response to the Kaddish and its significance. And so we have the way in which the Talmud presents it in a kind of, dramatic way. God is very pleased to hear this. And then the Hasidic way, explaining it in terms of the structure of the Sfirah. Is there any comment or question about that?
Why is there apparently worship of God's name, and isn't that in opposition to the notion of the oneness of God?
That's a very interesting question. And indeed, one of the attacks against the Kabbalah in sort of the 13th century, 14th century, was the idea of Sfirot. Doesn't that interrupt the idea of the oneness of God? However, in the Midrash, we do have very clearly the significance of God's names, and there are different names used for God in the Torah, and the Midrash, often quoted by Rashi, will explain why this name is used, which is the attribute of mercy, or why that name is used, which is the attribute of severity, and similar things like that. And God is seen to be one. I believe that the system of the Sfirot spells it out very clearly. At a lower level, you have the distinction between kindness and severity. At a higher level, you have only the absolute oneness of the divine. And that fits very well with the system of the Sfirot. In that, but it's a very reasonable question. Okay, so we've just got a couple of minutes left. Let's
Sorry,
just take a very short passage here.
Telly. Sorry to interrupt, but can you just say what you just said again? Just repeat it one more time.
You've got the 10 Sfirot, Cedric, and at the lower level of the Sfirot, there's a distinction between love and awe, or chesed and gvura, kindness and severity. That's at the lower level. But when you go to a higher level, there's Ein Sof, there's the radiance of the infinite, and that is beyond those distinctions. So at that higher level, there's only the oneness of God, beyond any kind of attribute. But at the lower level, one can speak about the mercy of God or the judgment of God, the throne of judgment, the throne of mercy, the Yom Kippur liturgy relates to this concept. Okay. Now,
Thanks, yeah.
another explanation of woe to the children who've gone in exile from their father's table. The Maggid of Mezritch taught, one is able to serve God with everything, even with eating something delicious, and one has delight in it. And through that, one can bring the delight to God. For God is the delight of all delights. So when the Talmud says, woe to the children exiled from the table of their father, it means they've exiled their father from their table. They have delight without including their father. So this is a very interesting way of looking at life, that our pleasures in life, whatever they might be, really can be seen as manifesting a divine pleasure, a divine delight, and it's our duty to seek that divine dimension when we enjoy those delights. And so that covers all aspects of life. And the way in which a person can see the resonance of the divine within everything that they do. So in this
Isn't that
text,
clear in every respect?
sorry?
I mean, isn't the transcendence of the world clear in every interaction we have with it? Because fundamentally everything is incomprehensible.
I'm not quite sure I understand what you mean, because what this is really doing is, it's, you see, there's an ascetic strain in Jewish thought, which is rejecting any kind of pleasure in the world, and saying that, this in some way is removing the person from a connection with the divine. Comes Hasidism and somehow makes a bridge that the pleasure in the world, let's say the food that a person eats on Shabbat, and nice food has been prepared, and people cooking the food have gone to a lot of trouble to make it very tasty. The very fact of eating that delicious food is the Kavod Shabbos, it's for the glory of Shabbat. This bridging of the physical and the spiritual is something that is particularly associated with Hasidism. And so I'm not sure if your question is answered there or fits into it, but that's the background to this concept. All right, now I did prepare another passage, which is on the text that I sent you most recently, 25 minutes ago, or an hour. Now it's an hour and 25 minutes ago, and you could read that. Which is also, it's about a very beautiful thing about King David and how at midnight the harp, which was over his bed, would wake him up, and then he would get up and he would sing praises to God. And there's a discussion of that in terms of the night, why at midnight, what the midnight joins the two halves of the night. The first half is severity, the second half is mercy. And midnight comes from an even higher level, which links, of course, to the Seder of the week that we just had, where Moses said, round midnight to Pharaoh, which is discussed in mystical teachings. So I hope, does anyone have anything to comment at this stage? Otherwise, I hope we'll be able to meet in 2 weeks' time. Okay. Thank you for your participation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank
Thank you.
Thank you.
That
Thank
was fascinating. Thank you very much.
you. Thank you.
Thank you.